Good morning. Welcome to Turnout Radio on CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm Nicole Inica Hamilton, back to open up with you about the latest on the dance scene and the heart of what moves us. Thank you for tuning in to share time and rhythm with us. Welcome to this dance space. Well, as we enter into the flow of today's conversation, as always, friends, we invite you to come in as we explore the stories that live both on and beyond the stage. And today, I am so thrilled to welcome my guest. My guest has shared that the following words are his guiding principle: do not let anything without life take yours. Coming up on the show, costume designer, dancer, and choreographer Bakari Ifa Segun Lindsay is in the house and will be with us for the full hour. So stay tuned and stay locked in right here to CIUT 89.5 FM. We're going to take a break and be right back with more of Turnout Radio right after this. Welcome back to Turnout Radio. I'm Nicole Inica Hamilton. Bakari Ifa Segun Lindsay is a Trinidad and Tobago-born fashion and costume designer, dancer, and choreographer with over four decades of artistic experience. He began sewing at age 19 and gained national recognition in 1985 when he won Best Designer at the Prime Minister's Best Village Trophy Competition. Now, throughout his career, Bakari has created more than 75 original costume and fashion designs for dance, film, and television, collaborating with companies such as COBA, Collective of Black Artists, Ballet Creole, Omo Dance Company, Oya Films, Atco Dance Repertoire in Haiti, and Les Enfants Dance Company. A multidisciplinary artist, Bakari's background as a dancer and choreographer informs his design practice, allowing him to create costumes that move seamlessly with the body and deepen the expressive power of performance. Deeply rooted in African and Caribbean cultural traditions, his work blends heritage and contemporary design, celebrating the aesthetics, history, and spirit of the African diaspora. Please join me in welcoming to the show Bakari Ifa Segun Lindsay. Bakari, welcome to Turnout Radio.
Thank you. How are you doing?
I am very well. I'm doing very well, and I'm so glad to be in conversation with you today. How are you doing as we enter into the space together?
You know, it's a blessed day. I think, you know, every day has to be a blessed day. You know, we have life and we have love. And I think if we enter the world every day with that perception, I think it's a beautiful day.
Yes, yes, indeed. Oh, I want to explore that just a little further. I learned a long time ago, and it was really through the journey of a very difficult time in my life, to really consider the space of that gratitude.
It's quite interesting because we often talk about gratitude. I feel as an intellectual capacity, and I think until that capacity is challenged in some way, it's then we begin to really actualize what that means. And for me, it was my diagnosis with multiple myeloma. I've always been full of gratitude. I mean, when you've been raised in a society that I have been in Trinidad and Tobago, and when you grow up with very little, you learn gratitude fairly early. So gratitude has always been part of my life. And as I got older and, moved to North America, it was there. It was there, but it wasn't actualized in the way it did when I was younger. And so when I was diagnosed with multiple myeloma and had to come to terms with, for a brief moment, that life was fleeting, and to go through the process of treatment and come out with healing, it reminded me of being grateful and honoring the moments of life, every single moment of day, whether you have achieved, whether you haven't achieved what you've planned for that day, but just existing in time, and the energy of the universe becomes very vital when you've had an opportunity to take time to wrestle with what it means to be alive.
As you reflect on the arrival and actualization of gratitude, Bakari, there is a guiding principle that you live by, which shares, do not let anything without life take yours. Can you share how that principle speaks to you and why it resonates with you?
It's a gift from my mother, who is no longer with me. I, was blessed enough to journey with her for 89 years, and she's gone to rest last year. And it was a blessing. And that particular saying was something that she passed on. She was a very spiritual person, and although quite rich, was very simple. And she often said, what does not have life should not take yours. And so for me, the reality is that things that I have absolutely no control over, I let it go and let the universe, let time, let space, let energy, let love, let, transcendence take its work. Things that I have control of, I go with it full force. And so for me, I'm able to have compassion when it's needed. I'm able to have give myself grace when needed. I'm able to live fully in the moment and in the time that exists for me.
Has that guiding principle informed your choreographic practices?
Most definitely, most definitely. I think as I come to a space of what people call the senior artist, the elder space as an artist, I think it's paramount in the way that I visit work. And when you're a younger dancer, it's all about that sense of perfection and achievement. And as I develop and grow as an artist, for me, it's about transcendence. It's about giving. It's about storytelling. It's about other things beyond the role of perfection of movement or technique. And I think that's one of the big things is that sometimes we beat upon ourselves too because we cannot achieve a certain type of physical attainment. And it's, and it, in some cases, it doesn't matter what you do, your body is not going to change. And therefore, what can you bring into the space and offer an audience within that particular work or that particular practice at that time? And so if I go back about, things that don't have life taking yours, is that, we remove the joy of dance, the joy of movement, the joy of being within the artistic practice, because we're striving for this thing that we may never reach and don't need to. And when you begin to understand and be comfortable with yourself and be honest with yourself, then the joy comes from not achieving.
I'm wondering, in that space of understanding, what have you discovered about your own arrival to self or your own understanding of self?
I think if I were to put it into one word, it's honesty. And I think from the word honesty comes different tentacles that has to do with generosity, has to do with joy, has to do with bountifulness, it has to do with, you know, growing, expanding, you know, giving and receiving, humble. There's so many adjectives that I feel that just jumps out of that word, you know? So for me, yeah, it's about all of those things.
Yes. You know what I think of as I'm listening to you share? I consider the amount of different surprises that have happened during the course of my life. When I was a younger artist, there were definitely different needs that I had. Yeah. There were different things that excited me.
Yes.
And there were also different interests that lived within my body. And so the getting older has been a pleasure to really begin to consider how it is that I myself am arriving in space. And so when you take a look back and you consider all of what you've shared with me, are there certain interests that now surprise you?
I think, I am an IFA practitioner. And part of that practice is that, you know, we believe that we're all born and placed on a journey. And I think, so for me, it is recognizing the path that that has been laid out for me and living that path and journeying along that path. So nothing surprises me. I think what I think for me now, it's being comfortable on the journey. And, you know, it's like, you know, sitting back in that beautiful chariot and enjoying the view as you go along. Whereas when you were younger, you know, you're going along and things went by, you didn't even notice it happened. I think now I can afford to sit in the chariot and lay back and look right and look left and look around and still know what's happening as I move forward. I can even look back and still be confident in how I'm moving forward. Because I think I'm just more aware. I am now, you know, noticing and accepting and grasping things fully in a way that, you know, is juicy and lovely to experience. And I'm grateful and I enjoy the experience at the moment. And sometimes it's almost deliberate in that I am digging to call and engage in with my spiritual existence in some ways. So it varies from time to time. Sometimes I think the most joyous of them all is when it happens unknowingly and you discover something about yourself that you go, wow, that's powerful. And you take the time to sit within it and be within it and learn from it and, you know, make those comparisons and look at those different mileposts in the journey and go, okay, I hear you, I see you, and now I accept you and acknowledge and invite you in.
What would you say is that idea or curiosity or that concern that rests most heavily on your heart as you navigate not only your practice, but life in general?
It's fascinating because before I truly understood and got into Yoruba practice, the deity that rests on my head is Obatala, which is the deity of creativity. And so therefore I am interested in everything. You know, I'm not a huge fan of horoscopes, but I often, you know, I would dabble and read things about Geminis. And I often laugh hysterically because, you know, a lot of the stuff that's written where I don't know where it comes from, I fit them to a T. I have so many interests. I have so many. And I don't just have fleeting interest, I have deep interest. And I think my perfectionist side of me often pushes me, propels me to, when I get interested in something, to get as deeply entrenched in it until I feel that I've, concluded. And I think that's the Africanness. We, it's funny, people always say, oh, Black people are always late. It's interesting, when I went to Africa, I understood some of the nuance of that, is that it's not in an African context that they're late. They, whenever something is happening, it has to be completed before they move on. So if I says I'm coming to meet you at 3 o'clock and we're going to have a conversation, but that conversation gets rich in some way, I'm not going to walk away because I have another appointment at 3:30. I'm going to stay with that conversation, that event, that whatever it is, until it's fulfilled, and then I go to the other thing. So, which would, in sort of a now context and a sort of a commercial context, I'm late. Like, wow, this is, I remember I went there with my very North American life, and I had, my list of things I needed to get done in a day, and I realized, Bukhari, you are only going to get one thing done in a day, because if you happen to go somewhere and this is going on, you're going to be stuck there for the day. So plan on only doing one thing. So to sort of get back to your question in terms of what interests me, I think my spirit decides. My spirit decides. Things, I encounter things, and my spirit says, this is something that's rich and needed for your soul. And I stay with it till it's done. It may not be, it may take years, it may take days, it may take months, depending on what it is, but I stick with it. In layman terms, I call it my stubborn streak, but I don't go away until I feel I've completed the cycle and the journey of it all.
Have you found that within the space of your journey, that awareness and understanding has shifted your relationship or understanding of time?
Yes, I definitely have learned to not restrict myself. And again, it sort of, I guess, ties back into that notion of what doesn't have life, taking yours and giving yourself the space to experience things in the fullest, and not restricting yourself to a time schedule or a time, frame. So I always allow space for me to fully experience things. And if I can't do it in a one go, I go back to it. And it's interesting, like I start projects and I realize I'm up till 2-3 in the morning working on it, because I just can't stop until certain portions of it is completed. And I thought, okay, you're getting obsessed now. But no, I think it's the way my spirit calls to a particular notion of completion, which is the African context, which is the personal spiritual context. There's so many things, converging together to make this one thing happen and whole and be well with thyself.
The prospects of time, I'm very often intrigued by its possibility, its expansiveness.
Yes. It's curious now that I find that, when I create work now, Michael, who works with me, he always, poor fella, especially if he has to dance the work after me or something, because I always, I create and I leave space for time, because every time I do the work, I'm not in the same emotional, spiritual place. And therefore, sometimes I need that breath to be able to expand a moment. You go on stage and the audience is feeding you a different kind of spiritual energy, and you have to navigate those energies before you can move on to the other thing. And, for me, I get very attuned, when I get on stage, and I can feel, as much as I have stayed in the studio and I've created, and I think that the ideas are clear or the particular moment is clear. When I'm on stage, I can feel that the audience sitting there, the energy that they're feeding me is that it is not clear enough. So can you please give me some more? And therefore, within the work, I feel that that needs to happen. You need to have space within the work to be able to do that. So I find that my choreographic structure within a particular piece has a beginning and an end. And what happens in between is often quite fluid, you know, within reason, you know. And so that idea of time for me, you know, I'm more and more, I tend to want it to be a little more flexible, a little more fluid, a little more languid, a little more loving, a little more caressing of us, our spirits and our souls, because sometimes we need that. You know, you're having a conversation with someone and you need that breath to be able to move forward and move away and move apart. And sometimes, you know, conversations and I shouldn't even say conversations, but meetings and partings are so abrupt that it leaves your spirit in shambles and shakes. And I think it's a big part of a lot of the emotional and mental health that we have, because so much of our communications is wired and cut short by time.
Stay with us. More of Turnout Radio coming up after this. Aferia is a physical language which you have developed. I'm wondering if you can share with us where the name of the method is derived from, and also if you can talk about the guiding principles that the method speaks to.
Aferi is sort of the technical pieces. It's the Manding word. So the word Firi is the Manding word for training or method. And so it's a Manding word. And I chose Manding because it was the primary geographic location of the ethnic group that when I worked, the Senegambia region. So I did, in terms of the continent, I did a lot of work in Senegal, the Gambia, Guinea, and that whole Senegambia region, doing a lot of ethnographic observations and to come up with the basic principles. To give you some background, I was probably about 19 and dancing with a folk dance company in Trinidad and Tobago. And the director at that time brought a woman in from Oakland, California, called Linda Faye Johnson. And Linda Faye Johnson was specializing in Guinea-styled West African dance. And literally, I remember the class started. We at that time we had 21 drummers in the company, so they were all lined off. And those guys, you know, they would purposely challenge us, and they were working with her all day, so they had learned all the rhythms, and then the dancers came in the afternoon, and so the drummers were all lined up, and she did the warm up, and we were top of our game. We weren't slouches. And all I remember is that she said something to the drummers and the rhythm started. And 1 minute she was standing in front of you, and the next minute she was across the floor. It was that fast. And I remember we all looked at each other and we just went, holy, what's about to happen? And that went on for weeks and weeks. We developed a plan. You get the legs, you get the abs, I'll get the torso. And we'd come in early and we'd try and trade off each other to figure out how we could get the steps. And just when we thought, you know, we had gotten one step, another step would show up. And I think, and that was kind of the genesis of Aferi. I was intrigued by, you know, traditional West African dance from the Senegambia region, didn't understand the pedagogical strategy in that, you know, it's a lot of it was coming from their lived experience. So for them, it was, you know, a natural thing, and didn't understand all of those ethnographic pieces. So that was kind of the beginning. So I started there. When I started doing my own teaching, I remembered in Toronto, I was teaching Sosone. And I had given the women this very basic step where, you know, it's a shuffle of the feet and the arms, were like you're, you know, when you're, if you're shaking a towel out from washing. And again, in the Caribbean, come on, we all know you, you know, we're used to washing by hand. And so I told the women, you know, pretend you're shaking a towel out. And then it hit me, Bakari, they all wash with machines. You know, then the full ethnographic process started. If you don't have a cultural context, how can you begin to have people understand your movement physically? So that was the thing of me developing a physicality of the movement and then encourage people to go and get the cultural context. But if they understood the body, you know, things like polyrhythm, polycentricism, you know, harmony and movement and all of those pieces. And so those are sort of the basics of a theory. It's that it's a physical language to understand the multiple use of the body. And in a theory in particular, it talks about the natural bends. So it's not a perfectionist technique. It's nothing to perfect, but it's something to utilize. So you under it's about understanding your body and being able to understand what your natural bends can allow. I mean, we talked about earlier, you know, being younger dancers and this ideal of perfecting something and getting better, but your body is not capable of doing it. With a theory, turns that on its head. It's about, you know, these are my natural bends and how do I understand my own natural bends of my body to be able to produce movement within a particular structure? And how do I strengthen those things? How do I understand not rhythm, but rhythm within movement? And, you know, it was personal experience. I remember, again, at the School of Toronto Dance Theater, I began training fairly late as you know, in terms of European tradition as a dancer. So I didn't have a history of ballet. I was thrown into a year three ballet class because the teachers looked at me and just assumed, because of how strong I was technically, that I'd had ballet. And I remember going into the class, and the way that I could remember the exercises is that I would tap the rhythm out on my leg. I would close my eyes and I would tap the rhythm. And I remember I got thrown out of class one day because she thought I was mocking her. And so after the class, she pulled me out and says, you know, this is what I'm seeing and whatever. And I said to her, I said, this is my first introduction to ballet. I said, and what I'm actually doing is tapping the rhythm of the steps out to be able to understand, you know, the pattern, because it was always so fast. I said, a tondu is a tondu. I know what a tondu is. But, you know, when it's back in front, once I memorized the rhythm of the movement, I could, you know, reproduce the pattern of what I had to do. The Koba dancers will tell you that I didn't count. When I choreographed, I didn't count. It was a whole symphony of rhythms. So if the piece was 35 minutes long, they had a symphony of rhythms. I would, you know, sing everything and, you know, ta-da, yeah, up. And so they would have that in the early stages of choreographing a work. I would come in and start choreographing on one piece of music. And then I would come next day because all the movement was based on rhythmic structures. I would come in one day, say, okay, let's run what we have. And I would put in an entirely different piece of music and say, let's go. And I would say it should not be any different because you have your rhythmic structure. So either it would be going juxtaposing what's being played, or it will fit harmoniously. You should not depend on the music that you're hearing to create the structure that I gave you yesterday. And that's the African tradition. You know, you look at a traditional West African work, and the dancers are carrying one rhythm, the drummers are carrying one rhythm, the singers are carrying one rhythm, depends, you know, if they have other things happening. So sometimes you have five different rhythmic structures happening, and everyone has the specific rhythmic structure, but it all comes together and bring this beautiful marriage. So that has been my choreographic philosophy when I create work, is that I often give the dancers a rhythmic structure, and I say, as the rehearsals go on, you may find within the piece of music that we're working with where it fits in. But I implore you to hold on to the rhythmic choreographic structure that I've given you to dance. The intentional acknowledgement of the rhythm in the space, whether it's silence or no silence, it's very intentional. And I'm often employing artists that I work with. And even when I perform, it is very intentional about the rhythms that are appearing in the space. And for me, I think, you know, the tradition that I come from is so vast and so beautiful. There's so much there that I don't need to create anything else. I can use it to say different things. But, you know, the guiding principles of harmoniously having multiple things happen at the same time and still be quite beautiful and pleasing and sitting in a place of comfort for someone looking on. So the guided principle of my creations. And again, it's about those natural bends. It's how can I support an artist to use what they, the facilities that they have to do what they can. Like I often say, you know, your body is not my body. And therefore what I would like you to look at is the shape, the body attitude, the story of each bend, each position, each tilt, each tuck. And those things are quite prevalent in, I would say, in most folk traditions. You go, you know, you go to Jamaica, you go to Trinidad, you go to Africa. And I mean, and that's the basis of the development. I sat for months just sitting and looking. I wasn't dancing. I wasn't, you know, moving. I wasn't playing. I was just sitting for me. I remember one of my favorite things to do in the afternoons, especially in Senegal, was to watch, because there were women that would come out to sell nuts in the afternoon. So they would put their coal pots out in the side of the road, and they would put coals and sand, and then they would put groundnuts in there, and they would heat it up, you know. And I would just sit and look at and they would just sit there for hours on end, and that elegance and the breath across the body. So when you tell a dancer to go on stage and just stand and be present, that power that they have. You know, you see them carrying a bucket of water for them to just be able to support that weight. But it doesn't look strained. It doesn't look, you know, forced. It just looks powerful. And it is powerful because it's active. It's holding, you know, a bucket of water. And it's just there. You know, it looks like it's just floating. And so it's those ideas and those principles that, you know, when I step on stage and people said, you know, you could just stand on stage and you just look so intense. But it's not an intensity, it's an intention of understanding that, you know, and those memories and those images of how the body is carried of my ancestry and the legacy that's birthed within me that I draw upon when I coach dance or when I perform. You know, it's about, you know, and I said dancers, like it's not casual business to be on stage, even when it's casual, because when they're standing on the side of the road, they are casual, but there's a power and an elegance to that stance. It's a natural power that you just cannot deny. And when we come on stage, we bring the ancestors with us that's alive. And so even if we're dancing Swan Lake, we can't get rid of who we are. We'll give you all the technique in the world, but that Black dancer is going to come with her ancestral spirits. It's the opening of Judith Jameson just standing on stage for Cry. She's not dancing. It's the curtain open, and you see her standing there. And you see the entire story of the millions of women that she's dancing for. And now when you see the younger dancers do Cry, you see every woman that have danced that work. But just by that single stance, and every woman who's done that work has to understand that legacy. This isn't performance. You are stepping on that box to be that sacrifice of every woman that has done that work. You know, and so you see that kind of innate knowing and that kind of true dedication, spiritual dedication, that's in work that you see all the time in the Black dancer.
Stay tuned. We have more with Bakari Ifeasegun Lindsay coming up right after this. You're listening to Turnout Radio on CIUT 89.5 FM. Bakari, as a fashion and costume designer, you have an interest in how garments move with the body and how design can enhance a performer's expression. And so can you elaborate, please? Tell us about the languages and the relationships between those interests.
You know, I think I'm lucky I was born in a time to two parents, who one of which my father was a tailor, and I was born in the 60s, so that could give you a time frame. And he was an impeccable tailor. He was impeccable. I mean, I remember there were other tailors who'd bring specific types of sewing to him. And so I grew up under those hands. I grew up looking at them. I grew up observing them. And when I was old enough to hold a needle, I was actually helping make them. And so I think inherently some of that detail and that skill was sort of passed down to me. And I think, blood memory, a bit of that is happening in there. So for me, I think it's part of my creative gifts that the same way I feel and endure movement, it's the same way I look at clothing and the way they fall. I think there's a certain elegance to me, I feel, that dancers must feel before they get on stage and in order to be able to fully execute. I think costumes and garments that they wear should make them feel beautiful. It should make them feel spiritual. It should make them feel grounded. It should make them feel expansive. It should make them feel on top of the world, beyond human. And therefore, when they get on stage, they can begin to do those things in the actual movement. It should move them. A lot of times people often have this feeling that the dancer moves the costume. And therefore, for me, in theory, it becomes a weight because they're moving this thing. And so for me, when I create costumes or clothing, the clothing should move you. If you're coming up, if it's a bridal gown, it should be that gown should be propelling you down the aisle in the way it fits, the way it hangs, the way it flows. It should give you life. You should be giving it life. And so that's kind of my principle when I create. I want, you should not be concerned about what you're wearing in the least. It should feel like your second skin. And when you go into all of those positions, it should be an extension of who you are.
So then, if movement has a language, then the garments that we wear
Must
also
speak.
has a language.
Yeah,
Yes.
they must speak. And they must speak because they are created to speak. So even when you're standing still and the way it falls should be saying something. So the moment that shape changes, it's because the space that we talked about earlier has transformed in a different way. So it has to move to adjust to the space that it's now in.
My sit down with Bakari continues after a short break. Stay with us. We have more of Turnout Radio coming up. Today's history segment takes us on a journey behind the career of Bakari Ifashegun Lindsay. Born Edison B. Lindsay on the island of Trinidad, Bakari Ifashegun Lindsay is a dancer, choreographer, singer, musician, costume designer and maker, and researcher. His passion for dance and culture is rooted in extensive training at the Alvin Ailey American Dance Theater, the School of Toronto Dance Theater, and with esteemed teachers from the Caribbean and the continent of Africa. Bakari holds a craftsman diploma in style and design, a master's degree in dance ethnology, and a bachelor's degree in education from York University in Canada. Co-founder of COBA, Collective of Black Artists, Bakari has performed with renowned companies, including the Danny Grossman Dance Company, Jubilation Dance Co., Toronto Dance Theatre, and ATCO Danse Repertoire. He was also an original cast member of Disney's The Lion King. Now, as a choreographer, Bakari has created works for Les Enfants Dance Company, Entre Deux, the National Dance Company of Trinidad and Tobago, Filadenko Dance Company, COBA, and the Afiri Project. Bakari has served on the faculties of Ryerson University, York University, Humber College, Lester B. Pearson School for the Performing Arts, and the Toronto District School Board. Now an author, Bakari chronicles his transformative journey through illness and recovery in his debut memoir, In Healing Steps, A Dance with Destiny. This powerful narrative reflects on his diagnosis with multiple myeloma, his battle to overcome challenges, and his eventual return to the stage, a testament to resilience, spirituality, and the enduring power of art. Bakari's artistic vision remains deeply connected to creating a harmonious balance between cultural traditions and contemporary practices, leaving a lasting legacy in both education and the arts. A vision that moves Bakari forward in today's featured history segment. To learn more about his work, visit afiri.com. That's AFEERE.com. Stay tuned for more shares from Bakari as we go inside the pages of his memoir, his journal, and his thoughts about rediscovery and the rhythms of life. Coming up next. Bakari Ifeasegun Lindsay is behind the mic with me today. Bakari, I'd like to go now to chatting about your book, In Healing Steps, A Dance with Destiny, which shares your transformative journey. Now, when writing its pages, what did the book reveal to you about rediscovery and the testament of healing?
It's just a very raw and vivid account of my journey with multiple myeloma. And for those who don't know what multiple myeloma is, it's a cancer of the blood. So I was diagnosed with multiple myeloma, and being the person that I am, you know, fairly stubborn, I was about, okay, what do I need to do to heal? And I mean, it comes back to that whole principle of what doesn't have life, let it not take yours. I was concerned about the parts that I had control over, and what should I do to, like, what does it mean? How can we heal? And so I had gone through the entire process, you know, chemotherapy. And so there were a lot of pieces that really took control of what I had known to be life. And so I went through all of that, and I came out of it, you know, very much in control. So I had my stem cell transplant in February. And in October, I was on stage dancing a 20-minute solo. So that was, 5 months later. I think the big push to writing the book was one of my really, really, really good friends, Debbie Nichols, who we'd often chat during the process, would always say, Bakari, you need to write, Bakari, you need to write. Because we would, you know, when we'd call, we'd have these long conversations, and we'd talk, and it's just, oh my God, that's so deep. Bakari, you need to write, you need to write. And I would say to her, yeah, fine. Because writing, I'm a dancer. So I knew I was going to put it in movement. That I knew was going to happen. You know, so I kept a journal. So I had a lot of notes about things that had happened. And two really major events happened, and it was almost a year or two after it happened. One of them, and I write about both of them in the book, was the death of Patrick Passens. And I didn't, I had met him briefly, and he had, I remember the first time I met him, he'd said, you know, yeah, you know, we're both, I have diagnosed cancer. And when I've seen him, he was doing okay. I didn't know the depths of how much, you know, how far in. And then he was hospitalized. And ironically, I was two floors down receiving my monthly treatment, and he was on the two floors up in the hospital. And I went to see him, you know, and we had a long chat, and then we went the hallway and we were reminiscing, and you know, and I spoke to his sisters and I said, you know, I'll come back and see you, you know, on the weekend. And then something happened and I didn't go back and see him. And the sister had, when I went to his repast, the sister said to me, you know, I was waiting for you to come back. You know, I really want you to come back and see him because, you know, I wanted you to talk to him because he had said to the doctors, my friend is in remission and how can, and why can't I be in remission? And that really hit me really hard because I started questioning who gets to decide who lives or who dies. And so that was the first thing saying, I have to find somewhere to put this emotion because it was really laying heavy on me. And the second was my past school, there was a teacher there. I remember when I first went to the school, she would always say to me, oh my gosh, you remind me so much of my dad. You remind me so much of my dad. So she came to me one day and says, you know, I just found out, you know, I came to you because I know you've gone through it because she found her dad had cancer. So she had come to me and so she we had this long conversation. And so when the dad passed, I went to the funeral. And I remember it was on a Saturday, and usually on Saturdays, spiritually, I wear white, which, you know, a lot of people, you know, unless it's very specific, you know, very odd at funerals, but I had to wear white. So I showed up and I remember I sat at the back and this gentleman came running up the side when he saw me and says to me, I want to thank you so much because, you know, you just look so great because that's exactly what dad would want. And I was like, okay. And it turned out it was his son. It was her brother. But as the funeral went on and people were giving their tributes, his life sounded so much like my life. He can sew, he could cook, he was like all the things that I did in my life. And he was, you know, people talk about his fashion and he was always so impeccably dressed. And so those two pieces, I just had to put this emotion somewhere. So I decided to write about my journey. So I would talk about the whole process of, you know, how it began and what happened. And at the end of each chapter, I talk about what I've learned. So there are these little quotes and these little antidotes at the end of each chapter about, you know, survival, about perseverance, about gratitude. And so, you know, for me, I feel it's one of those raw memoirs of reminding us that when you triumph, don't take it for granted. Remember to genuinely have gratitude in a way that is real and actionable. Whenever I wake up, everything that I'm able to do, everything that I have, everything that I earn, anybody that I help, I do it with a sense of joy and a sense of gratitude. And I remember saying to myself, this is going to be okay. Because somehow I have this deep spiritual feeling that things that I needed to do on this earth that I have not done yet, there were things that I needed to complete in this journey. Thank you.
Bakari, we're nearing the close of our interview. It was wonderful to share time with you today. Before you leave for the day, what are your closing reflections or thoughts about your guiding principle?
Be generous with yourself and be generous with others.
Wonderful. Well, Bakari, it was a pleasure to have you on the program today.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining me on Turnout Radio. I look forward to being in conversation with you again very soon.
Thank you.
Welcome back to Turnout Radio. That was Bakari Ifeasegun Lindsay joining me on the program today. Such a pleasure to sit behind the mic with Bakari. And folks, if you missed the top of the interview, we invite you to visit turnoutradio.com, CIUT.FM, and some of your favorite podcast platforms where this episode will soon be streaming. Now, turnoutradio.com is also where you can find our library of past interviews, a list of resources, and our contact information. To connect with our production team via email, you can do so at turnoutradio@CIUT.FM. On today's program, you've been listening to the sounds of John Coltrane with Blue Train, Cannonball Adderley with Autumn Leaves, and Oscar Peterson with I Can't Believe You're in Love with Me. Well, this brings us to a close of today's program. Thank you for tuning in to share time and rhythm with us. Join us again next week for more of Turnout Radio right here on CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm Nicole Inika Hamilton. I hope your week finds you turning out to dance. Thank you.